Hello, I am Sebastian Teotrio.
And I'm Alex Hollingsworth.
Welcome to The Hidden Curriculum,
a podcast where we talk about all the stuff you didn't learn in graduate school. Hey everyone, I hope that you had a great week. We are excited to bring you an episode today. Before we get started, I got to know from Sebastian, what is your go-to coffee order?
Oh, that's a good question. So it's definitely seasonal. There's seasons in which I'm a strictly
Are you a pumpkin spice latte person?
No, I'm not a pumpkin. Actually, okay, I had my pumpkin spice latte this year. That was my first one after 10 years of being in the United States. But no, seasonal as in like sometimes I like black and then I go into this phase where I only drink black coffee. So it's just like very easy. And sometimes I really want milk. And so is either a breve or a latte. And sometimes like French press it, because I don't know why I really like French press, even though I have no taste in coffee. So those are my regular like seasonal that I change every year. What about you? What's yours?
So if I'm at a coffee shop, I like to get drip coffee because I feel like it's a good marker of like, is this a good coffee shop or not?
Right.
But when I'm at home, I have this like, I copied Cody Wing, one of my coworkers, and I bought this like preposterously fancy pour over kettle. So I actually have been made so much pour over coffee recently. I had to stop drinking caffeine and take a PPI because I was getting heartburn so bad.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So that's not good.
I like coffee a lot. What about that's you, Ariel? What's your go-to coffee?
I am an espresso guy. So that's what I drink at home. I have actually right next to me the Nespresso machine. So I don't even have to stand up. So that's
how excellent. Do you add anything to it?
No, just straight up, no, you know, black, you know,
you don't mess around.
Sugar, no sugar, nothing, just straight espresso. When I go to a coffee shop, it's slightly different. I want to make it last. So I get a latte or a cappuccino or something like that. Generally, that's what I get. So
maximize that time with that Wi-Fi.
You know? Exactly. Yeah. That's what you pay for, right?
Yeah.
At a coffee shop, right?
It was really funny because when I was a grad student, I would literally feel like I was like setting up a tent. It was like my huge bulky laptop, you know, put the thing there, iPad and this and a stand and the keyboard.
You would
and
bring a stand?
Keyboard. I would bribe because I didn't like the keyboard of my laptop. So it was just like a huge thing. And I was like, I'm going to stay here for 6 hours. Okay.
Yeah. You write like one email and then you pack it all up and you leave.
Yeah, exactly right. You're like, okay. Yeah. But now I'm more of a minimalist. So I changed my ways. Great. So our special guest today is Ariel Ortiz Bovea. Ariel is an assistant professor of applied economics and policy. He's an applied economist with interest in agriculture, research, and development economics. Ariel was a fellow at the Resource for the Future prior to Cornell and a special assistant to the Minister of Environment in the Dominican Republic prior to grad school. So that's super cool.
Fancy.
At present, his research program is broadly focused on agricultural sustainability issues, with a particular emphasis on a statistical and econometric evaluation of the climate change impacts on agricultural and other sectors of the economy. Woo, I made it. How are you doing today, Ariel?
Very good. That's a mouthful. Thanks for having me.
I love people reading people's bio because it's like, oh man, this is so cool. So Ariel, we always like to ask our guests to share a fun fact about themselves. So what's your shareable fun fact?
Well, the first, maybe I'll do a couple, but the first one is a very fun fact, I'm actually an associate professor since last summer.
Oh my God, sorry. Wow, you should have corrected me.
I actually, you know, I just wanted to surprise you with that.
Okay, exclusive. This is exclusive content from the Hidden Curriculum to the world. That's right.
Yeah, so that's my fun fact. You know, maybe another one would be, that I started studying biology. I started as a biologist and I wanted to grow flowers when I was 18 years old. And so you can start, you know, with very funky different plans and then end up as a college professor.
Who radicalized you to economics?
It was a lecture on global food security.
Tulip mania.
Yeah. It was a lecture, actually. I can remember very vividly. And I felt like I couldn't grow flowers for a living. So I just felt like I cannot do this.
That is some lecture. Have you sent that person like a note being like, by the way, you changed my life? Like,
I'm a tenured professor at Cornell now.
Yeah. He's retired now, but I've told him that before.
That's awesome.
That's super cool.
Thanks. Thank you for doing that.
Yes.
Yeah. You are a complier of this lecture. Well, great. So before we dive into today's topics, we love to talk about our guests' research or something they would like to promote. So is there any paper or some project that you would like to promote for our audience listeners?
Yeah, I'd love to. So there's a couple of things. One is that I co-organize a online workshop. It's called the Online Summer Workshop in Environment, Energy, and Transportation Economics.
It is very good, by the way.
Or OSUIT. So there's a group of us who have teamed up, you know, Sarah Jacobson, Catherine Wagner, Ed Rubin, Katie Hossman, Antonio Bento, Maxwell Hammer, and myself. It was really a response to the pandemic and the fact that juniors and students don't have these places to network and get to know each other. And so we said we need to do something. And that's our response to that. So awesome. We have, you know, an hour of presentations. Generally, now we have like three papers, no discussion, it's not recorded. So the stakes are low. You know,
every week or every other week?
Every other week. So it's every couple. So we have a session actually today. Okay. And then we have half an hour of a happy hour.
So, nice.
So we do breakout rooms in Zoom, and we randomly shift them every 15 minutes. So we have two breakout rooms, and you get people, you know, get to know people you didn't know before.
Or awesome. See, faces. Yeah, we'll put the link down in the show notes, so make sure you check that out. Thank you.
Yeah, so join, especially if you're a grad student, junior faculty. Like you, we cannot let the pandemic, pull us apart.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The other thing that I wanted to talk about is also related to the topic, because I actually use this tool in this paper. It's a recent project that is looking at the historical impacts of climate change on global agricultural productivity. And I'm very excited about this work because a lot of the work on climate change is generally forward-looking. We're looking things into the future, mid-century, end of century, but there's already major changes that have happened to our climate system, and it's sort of looking back at how much these historical impacts are already being felt. So what we do in this paper is that we link detailed weather data with country-level total factor productivity for the ag sector for virtually every country in the world. Wow. And we go back in time and rely on counterfactual weather trajectories coming out of climate models. So we can sort of simulate what the weather conditions would have been without humans influencing the climate system. And then we have also trajectories of how the weather looks with human influence. And so from that counterfactual, that difference in those two types of scenarios, we sort of back out how much agricultural productivity has been affected by ongoing climate trends due to humans.
And that's a negative effect?
We find it's a negative effect. It's actually much larger than I thought it would be when I started this project. I was honestly expecting something around like 5% with the zero within the confidence band. And we're getting a result for the baseline model of about 20% reduction since the 1960s. It's equivalent to 7 or 9 years of lost productivity growth since the 1960s. So it's as if, you know, productivity is growing.
It's like you wipe out a decade.
Out a decade out of six decades. So it's a big effect. And one of the things that we do in the paper is that we try a bunch of different specifications. And that's where that specification chart that we'll be talking about later comes in.
And before we get to discussing this amazing specification chart, I'm going to talk a little bit about workflow. So this has been a thing that we've added to recent episodes where we like to ask our guests just how they approach their day-to-day workflow. The spirit of the question is basically to share, how do you approach doing things? How do you know what to do when you start your day? And then what do you actually do rather than like maybe what your idealized day is? So I just sort of let you take that as an open-ended prompt if you're comfortable with it.
Yeah. So I'm a relatively old school person in terms of how I go about organizing my day. I use index cards with a to-do list. Apps. So I'm an old millennial, I guess. And I have different index cards. I have index cards for different time horizons. So I use a index card for projects where I track the progress of those different projects. I have index cards that are getting me things to do in the next week or so. And then I have a daily index card where I have all the things that I had to do in that day. And what I generally do is that I plan what I'm going to do the following day, the day before, so that I don't have to do that in the morning.
How do you, where do you store this index card? They're just like laying in your desk.
Yes. I have them on my desk, which is a very risky strategy. Because right? If I lose them, then I'm like a lost soul.
And how many index cards do you have at any given point in time on your desk?
I generally have three. Sometimes, okay, depending on some projects, depending on how intensive things are and how many projects I'm dealing with at the same time, I might have an index card per project so that I have exactly what I need to do for each one of those. That's generally how I... I have my stack of index cards for each project.
So what's like your total working memory stack of index cards like maybe like 100 or something, and you like put it in your bag like when you travel? Or
no, I reuse them and recreate them very frequently. When they start to get messy, I recreate new ones. I don't like to keep many of them. That's why I have a large a overall project one that has all the projects, the active projects in them, so that
an index of index cards.
So yes. Exactly. It's like exactly. Let's me see the forest, more just the trees. I think that's important to keep a perspective of everything that is going on around it. So one of the downsides of this is that if it's not in the index card, it's as if it doesn't exist. So very risky in that regard, if you are not exhaustive or careful with putting things that are important for you.
So when you you started doing this, and did you eventually try to change, or have you not tried to adapt another system because you're like, this is working for me, why do I need to move to another system?
I think it works for me primarily for projects where I'm the lead person and I'm doing a lot of the work. I have not yet managed to adapt the system to, say, I'm giving directions to a research assistant. So that's something that I definitely need to improve on. That's like, if I had to improve something, that would be that, managing other people, which is very difficult.
You give them an index card, right?
Yes, and I can see them from a distance, exactly what you're doing.
So did you get this from David Allen's Hipster PDA?
No, it actually came back to how I manage my daily activities at the Ministry of the Environment before grad school. I had so many things to do, a crazy number of different things to do on a daily basis. And that was the way that I managed just too many tasks. And so I just took that and brought it to grad school. And then now to my position now.
So two things. One, you have described, by the way, the Hipster PDA from David Allen's Getting Things Done. So other people use a very similar system. It's hipster because it's all analog, but then number two, how do you decide? So it's cool. I love this idea that you have all these lists. This is a common thing people have been bringing up when we talk with them. But so you're scrolling your lists the night before. How do you decide which one, which list you pull out and which item you take off? And how do you decide to structure that week or day?
It depends on my mood and depends on the structure of the day. If there's some things that I cannot move, there's a bunch of meetings in the middle, there's things that I can do where I need a lot of time, deep thinking. And so I cannot do that in a day where things are hectic. And there's things that I can do very quickly, others not. And so it depends. And I try to plan my day so that I strategize on when do I have to have deep work and others where I'm just managing things.
Call Newport.
And just pushing things away from me to make the room to get to deep work.
That's great. And so you skim all the lists the night before, or do you just like, there's a couple like projects where you're like, yeah, those are at the back of my stack and like, they're going to stay there for 6 months.
It could be one thing that it depends. I think one thing that is important for productivity is understanding yourself as a person and understanding your mood and when you might be productive at certain tasks in certain days. There are days that I feel that I cannot read. And so that day I have my backup plan, and generally my go-to task is coding. I can code with music, with noise. It doesn't really matter. doesn't matter. I can code with, you know, standing up anywhere. And so that's, I try to keep certain tasks that are very manageable. And so I can try to fill the day with these little pieces of projects. So generally that's how, I have a plan, and then there's always a back way, backdoor option there.
I have one question. What about like what deadlines that are set up like 6 months from now? Like how does your brain or your system internalize those?
That's a tricky question. I'm not great with those. I have a hard time working on projects where, say, it's a review paper that requires a lot of work over time. And what I do is that I do have them in a to-do list, and I just put the date next to it and know that a couple of weeks before the due date, I need to start putting it in my daily to-do list.
So it moves up.
So that's generally how I do it.
This is great. This reminds me of why I really liked taking handwritten notes when I was in school, because I feel like the process of rewriting things was really important. And to study for exams, I ended up literally rewriting my notes. And I feel like by you rewriting your to-do lists, it's sort of like where's the grooves more deeply in your brain, just keeping you're always sort of remembering what you've got where. And that probably helps you like strategize and think about sort of when you're talking about like playing Tetris with the day and all these different things, you've kind of got like a low level awareness of all these different tasks.
Exactly. Cool. And every time that you rewrite a to-do list, your daily one or your weekly one, you restate your priorities. There are things that seemed important a week ago that now they're not, and you're able to readjust that.
Plus you can scratch something off your to-do list, rewrite your to-do list.
That's the best part of the game, right?
All right. Well, do you have anything else that you'd like to share on this topic before we transition?
Well, here's one important thing related to this idea about having a to-do list and breaking tasks into small pieces. I think that it's one of the strategies that really help you stay focused and not feel overwhelmed. I remember from grad school, one of the advices that our professor gave us was, you don't see people just chewing a whole baguette in one go. They break it, they break the little tip, and then they start chewing a piece at a time.
Depends on how much beer they've had.
And there's a movie actually that I always think back to, the documentary called Touching the Void.
And
it's about a climber that does the impossible almost. And there's a piece in that movie where the guy is saying that he broke both his legs and he had to drag himself for miles.
Oh my gosh.
Under freezing temperatures. And he said, when I thought about what I had to do to survive, it just felt impossible. And what he did, the brilliance of that moment of trying to survive, was that he set small goals. He would see a little rock or something, and then he knows that in 15 minutes, I'll crawl to that location. And he would just drag himself in the ground, over the ground, and just get there. And he would be disappointed if he missed it for, if he was like 2 minutes late to that spot. And he would do it, and he would do that over and over again. And the guy survived to tell the story.
But I think about that all the time too, because in that same scene, he talks about how he didn't even know if the direction he was going in was the end goal. he didn't even know which way was camp necessarily. I mean, he had maybe a guess. So he was like, but I just knew I had to keep making progress. So
So to-do lists in a way are that, you know, when a project seems completely unsurmountable, then you just have to break it into little pieces. And then all those little pieces make the project at the end. So you have to start somewhere.
Thank you for discussing your workflow with us. So I think today we can shift into sort of something you alluded to earlier, which is this awesome, I don't know if there's like a name for it, but this robustness checks aggregated figure. How did this come about?
Great. The way that it came about is that I saw it on Twitter. I saw Hans Severston. I don't know if you follow him. So H.H. Severston. And he has a specification chart coded in Stata. And he plotted that. And I saw this figure. I was like, wow, this is cool.
Right.
And that's the first time that I saw one that I can remember. And but the reason that I started adopting it and coding my own version in R is out of frustration, with reviewers, getting requests for or rejections based on simple tweaks of your model that don't seem that important. And at the beginning, you don't do everything. And you think, well, you have to leave something there so that you cannot, you know, it's not an encyclopedia, a paper, right? So you there's some things that you could do that you don't do in your first version when you submit. And then you wait for the reviewers to give you feedback. If it's fundamentally flawed, okay, they can recommend rejections. But sometimes it's on small things that they recommend rejections are not that fundamental. And out of that frustration came my desire to try to show how robust this is to a bunch of things that people would think about changing about this model. So that's how it came about.
That's interesting. So that's actually an interesting experience of how you adopted it. Because if I think of like a student telling me like, oh, I got rejected and they wanted me to do this, you know, whatever, a couple of robustness things that I don't have, I would have probably said to that student, well, maybe they're just using that as a reason to reject your paper. But in reality, so like do you think that's the case? And then you're just like behaviorally reacting, or do you think like, oh no, now that I'm using robustness checks, this is actually like improving my chances of acceptance in anecdotal evidence?
The way that I think about this type of plot, this specification chart, is trying to get to the R&R, right? Mm. It's getting to the revision
the rebound, so you can.
Yes, exactly. I need the rebound.
Yeah.
So I see it as a way of cutting down on the low-hanging fruits that the reviewers can come up with. It's not going to make your identification strategy better. It's not going to make the quality of the paper, in essence, the core of the paper, is not going to change. What you're trying to show is how variations of simple modeling decisions can change the results. Mm-hmm. So that's how I see it. So it's not a panacea. It's a way of guarding you and just being upfront about how these results really vary with just simple modeling assumptions.
So I've adopted this after seeing yours and other people sort of post this online for a paper that I'm working on now. And I wish I would have done this in a couple prior papers, because I had reviewers complain quite a bit about the length of some of my appendices, because I tried to, it's just like you were saying, Sebastian, as like preemptive. I wasn't really thinking about why I was being rejected.
Right.
I was looking at the words that were said. And I think it probably was just like, they were like, I don't like this paper, next. And then I wrote some reasons, but I was like, let me think about everything I could do. Right. And I made a table for it. And they're like, this is ridiculous. You expect me to read like 70 pages of like random tables? Like, get out of here. And this sort of chart can replace that. And then you could have like a couple sentences that are like, hey, you know, and actually everything's really stable near my preferred specification unless I do these things. And that actually might be just like, hey, sometimes there's noise and you don't find it, but it could be informative about like stuff that's going on in the data or different samples that have different properties. And we'll post a picture or a link to a picture in the show notes so you can see what one of these looks like. Maybe one of your Twitter threads, Ariel.
Yes. So that's a great point.
And I think so is there a concept of like this my result passes this set of robust checks? And what I'm thinking is that I'm not sure if I would expect my coefficient to be stable, because if I'm taking out some fixed effects, whatever, I'm just adding bias, right, to that baseline. So like, how do you only pick things that ex ante you would think like these are fine, or you pick just all the iterations of it?
So I think it depends on the purpose, right? Mm-hmm. So this is a tool, and then you can use it in different ways. You can use it for very bad objectives.
Yeah. Run 10,000 things, show 100 that look good.
Exactly. You could do that. So it can be misused. So I think that it really depends on the goal. Why are you using this? So you have to have a good reason for wanting to use a tool like this. If you're working in a literature where you know that reviewers, from experience, you can tell that these are things that the reviewers want to see anyways, you might just include them instead of having, because the figures are in the main paper, tend to take more room or tables. And then if you want to try 10 different models, then you have to replicate those figures like 10 times in the appendix. That's not an efficient way when what the reviewers want to see is just the main result with those variations. So I think that if that is a goal, then you can try all of them. And if you find one that the results are changed dramatically because you excluded a fixed effect of something, that's where you discuss, right? That's where the essence comes in, is that, okay, this is actually making a difference. Mm.
So I've used this in another paper before, and I guess, of course, it's exactly the same thing, but I hadn't thought about it before, where we were dropping each treated state, which is like a common thing that people ask to do, like which state is driving the identifying variation, and putting that in a coefficient plot, where being like, here's each state that I dropped next to each other. I guess it's basically the same idea here, right? We're like, look at all my 95% confidence intervals. Look, when I drop California, it widens. When I drop New York, good, turns the opposite sign or something, you know, like.
So you can use it not only for changes in your specification, but for data restrictions or for heterogeneity if you're looking at effects across different parts of the sample. Right. So that's something that you can do and show with the same type of plot.
When you talked about this on Twitter, because Twitter is such a wonderful platform, let's say, I imagine that you got some reactions that were not all positive. So what was the pushback that you think you were seeing from people?
I think the main pushback from people who would be otherwise supportive of this is, I'm afraid of using this tool because the reviewers will never have enough. Mm.
Something else they could add.
Exactly. Right. And that is true. I can read you. So I'll read you one sentence from a referee report I got.
Ooh, excellent.
I wish we had a soundboard. Yeah, so we could have like a scary music here. Like, dun, dun, dun,
dun. Yeah, that's right. I should.
Here's a quote. The authors are to be commended for subjecting their model to a wide range of robustness checks. Now it comes the deadline.
Yeah. Dun, dun, dun.
One additional robustness check I recommend. There you go. So I'm not going to read the rest of the sentence, but you get the point, is that there's always something, right? And that's fine, I feel, because I'm trying to get to the revision. And and if they ask another robustness check, well, then so be it. But if I didn't have that charge and you just copy and then showed just a couple of variations, and then they really thought that my results wouldn't hold if I tried something else, then they would be inclined to say, I don't buy this, without even seeing the evidence that it actually holds. So I think that that's one of the pushbacks that I've seen, in terms of there's always more to ask.
Do you think, so this is like maybe a more question for a longer discussion, do you think some people are like afraid to do this stuff? The one thing I noticed when people started talking about like, the AAA is going to require code now for the AAJs and AAR. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are like, this is outrageous. Like, I can't believe they would require code. And my kind of thought was like, I mean, yeah, it's hard, but like, that's awesome. I can't wait for the code to be online. And do you think any of the pushback was related to that or no?
I think that there is a fear that just a one robustness check might undo years of work.
Yeah.
Right. And if it is the case, then we are all better off Okay.
Right.
So we have to understand the private incentives that people have, and then they might just want to be willfully ignorant about some things and they don't want to discover things, especially when you're in an advanced stage in a project. But I think this is a good move in terms of us being transparent, especially when we're explicit. Okay, these are things that I'm going to try to show, how my results show with all these changes and these assumptions. If you do that early on in your project, then you know where you stand. If you just go with that first model where you got the significant result and then build, you know, months and years of work based on just a couple of specifications without really addressing other potential variations, then you're walking on thin ice. You don't know if you're walking on thin ice. And I think it's there's a fear out there, but I think it's a good fear because we should always be worried about these things. And maybe this just makes it systematic that we should be worried from the beginning about the robustness of our results.
Yeah. And I have another question sort of related to this. If you, let's say a reviewer is listening to this or a potential reviewer, all of us, and then you're reviewing a paper that has one of these, but it's not like perfect, right? Like they do a good job and they show in like 5% of them, you know, cross zero or even have like a different sign and are significant. Like what advice do you have for a reviewer who's reviewing a paper that's used something like this?
I think I saw recently Jason Lindo used, posted on Twitter. He used one of these graphs and some of the variations were not statistically significant at conventional levels. And he was pretty upfront. It's like, it is what it is.
Right.
And you have to just, what does that mean? I think it just invites people to think, how do you interpret the fact that this is not statistically significant at conventional levels? We are researchers, not just machines. So this tool is being used and you have to interpret and use theory and your understanding of the problem to know how you're going to interpret that. So that would be my answer, is that it depends. And I think it shows, I think we have to be more transparent. There's so much filtering that goes on when you write a paper about the things that work, the things that don't work, don't never enter the paper. If you tie yourself to the mast and say, I'm going to show you all these variations, that's unreasonable.
Tie yourself to the mast is so foreboding sounding. It's like the storm is coming.
Yes. And then you just say up front to yourself, it makes me think a little bit as a sort of a registering your experiments ahead of time. If you show these charts, they have to be systematic, right? You cannot just cherry pick the ones that worked because it is obvious when you do that in the charts because all the information is very concentrated. So if you're picking years, it looks fishy. So it has to be fairly systematic where you even allow combinations of different modeling assumptions. So I think it's a good thing.
And that's even what's occurring now, right? I think when we write papers, we're choosing our robustness checks and we're not necessarily choose all of them. And so we choose, you know, the ones that maybe are very intuitive or the ones that, like, you know, a lot of people are going to ask about this one, right? So we're still, there's still some selection into the robustness checks. Like, we don't have this like randomization inference for robustness checks. Like, this is a little bit close to that. You see, the thing that I think is useful, and if you're a PhD student listening to this, I think this exercise is useful, not necessarily because of like what the referee is going to say, but for you to learn what your baseline specification is doing. Because I think when you do this, like, what if I change X, Y, and Z? When I've done this in my own project, I started to learn things that I did not notice that my baseline specification is doing. And even if it doesn't get end up in the paper, the fact that you're learning that, it's already useful from my point of view.
I totally agree. And this is going to reveal a lot of ignorance on my part, but like I really learned to think about applied micro when I was like doing my first couple applied micro papers, not necessarily in class, but like when I was doing them, I like, oh, that's why they taught me that thing in class. Like it finally started clicking. And one of the things that like is so blindingly obvious to me now, but like wasn't immediately clear was when you throw in a lot of fixed effects, you're crushing your identifying variation often. And like sometimes it's great because you're like throwing away bad things, but sometimes you can throw out the baby with the bathwater. So it could very well be that like you need this fixed effect for identification. But if you put in this other one that sounds reasonable, it just crushes your identifying variation. So then now it's like nothing is ever going to be significant because like your R squared is like 99 or something. And I think that's kind of what a neat thing that one of these specification plots could do. Cause you could be like, oh, I need like county fixed effects. And you might be like, oh, it actually makes sense that I need those. But like as soon as I add like county by year, the whole thing goes away because it's like at the same level of my data, you know, like it doesn't even have a thing. So
I haven't tried it in full disclosure, obviously, because I feel it's fairly new. What let's talk a little bit about like the I think the fear of like this seems really complicated to code up and to use and to apply. What's your take on that?
Well, my take is that already there's people who already coded it. So if you work in Stata, there's implementations in Stata. There's an implementation in R that I've written. There's other implementations in R. Actually, my thread and on Twitter, I give links to those other implementations in other languages. I've seen even an implementation in Python. So there's a lot of different languages where people are just coding this up. And in my and the one that I have that I is posted on GitHub, and so I have a thread on Twitter about this. I even give a reproducible example of a hedonic model where I go take a paper from the 70s and there's, you know, and I just show what the possibilities are and how you can tweak the figure, change the colors. There's a bunch of things that you can do beyond what you see normally in just one in the frontline thing.
One quick question before we transition out. How many papers that you have that you've submitted have this now?
I would say that now the majority of the papers that I'm putting out have a version of this.
So you'll have soon anecdotal evidence of what it does to your rejections. But yes. You're also getting older, so that sucks.
Yes. It doesn't suck. It means he's going to be better.
But it sucks for the comparison, right? Who's the Arial counterfactual? That's what we need to find out.
So I'm working on a series of papers, and sometimes it's because I'm the lead and I put the figures on, and others it's just because the co-author is saying we need that figure in the paper.
Right. So every week we like to ask our guests for our recommendation of the week. This can be anything: a book, a command, an app, a song, anything that makes your life marginally better. So what is your recommendation of the week?
So my recommendation of the week might save, especially if you're a grad student, might save you a lot of time. I know it saved me time, and is to realize and appreciate that you're not coding for yourself, that you're coding for others, and that others includes you in the future. I know that you guys have mentioned this at some point in the podcast in different ways. And I think that's perhaps as people who are coding the big chunk of the day, I cannot just understate how important that is to always be thinking about replicability and how you're going to come back to this code a week from now, 3 months from now, 3 years from now. Mm-hmm. It's going to happen. and it's going to happen.
Or somebody else's.
Yes, somebody else's, but it might include you. And and so one useful rule that I have is when I'm the lead, especially, I don't submit a paper that it's not fully replicable at the moment that I submit it. Everything is already written down.
That's awesome.
The README file, everything is ready so that I can move on fully to something else mentally. And then just wait for the reports to come back or the rejection.
And you gotta throw that index card away, you know. Yeah. I don't have to deal with that project anymore.
Exactly. And could you know, and so I think that's a good good rule to have.
Yeah. Awesome. Alex, what is your recommendation of the week?
All right. So this came, I didn't even like realize that this was gonna be a good tip of the week until Scott Cunningham had this like thing on Twitter this week where he was like, I use one password because I hate editorial manager.
And that's a good one.
So I started doing this thing where I was resetting my password every time I was asked to do a referee report or had to submit a paper or wanted to check the update of a paper. Like every day I was resetting my password on editorial manager somehow.
Oh gosh, it's so painful.
Yeah, it's not really that painful, but it's useless. It's like a waste of time. And so I just started changing my login to be like HOLLINA_ and then like the initials of the journal, like Jerry or Jim. And it makes my life so much better because like I use 1Password and I like it, but like I don't need to have like all my editorial manager stuff in my like vault of like credit card passwords and whatever. Like I want them in keychain so I can like do it on my phone or my computer. So I can like so quickly now be like, Helena Jeem. All right, that's the one for Jeem. And it's made my life a lot better doing that.
That's awesome. That's interesting. Great. My recommendation of the week, it's going to be to check out a service called Unsplash. So that is UN and then Splash.
Is that a towel company? What is that?
It's not a towel company, although it should be. Although I should have a recommendation about towels. I love towels. This is literally just a picture service. So it's just like pictures that people have taken that are very nice and curated, and you can download them, use them for free. I love to browse that to use for backgrounds for my phone, for my computer, for stuff like that. I think there's always, you know, there's a ton of these services. Unsplash is one that once I moved, I never moved out of it. So it seems like
Wait, these all have Creative Commons license, right? On this website?
But you can still, what does that mean? I don't know.
So I'm pretty sure I used this when we did our episode on like how to build a website on your own, because I was looking for like a photo I could reuse without being sued.
These
are reusable
photos.
Right?
Exactly.
I might not have said the Creative Commons thing right. I don't really know.
It sounded fancier. I just like it because it has really, and you can like search, and the search function works really well. So if you're looking for changing, and I change my wallpaper every 2 months or something like that, because I like variety. I don't know why. So that's my recommendation of the week. Awesome. Well, thanks for being here with us today. If people want to find more about you and your work, Ariel, where should they go?
They can probably just go to Twitter and Ariel Ortiz Bobea, and then from there, there's a link to my website and to, you know, Threads and on this.
Awesome.
I have one last addendum of a fun fact about Ariel. So he, if you don't know, his colleagues let me know, he has mad sweater game. He wears the best sweaters in the business. And I actually wore my sweater today to match him. And he's wearing like a pullover thing right now. So it's not like one of his
like, but sweaters with like sweaters. Full sleeves or short sleeves? Yeah. Or
Cardigans. I play the cardigan game. I didn't do it today. But that's generally how I roll. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Time you see him, be on the lookout.
I'm gonna expect
to
have
a
very
threads.
Nice cardigan. That's right. That's so funny. Great. Well, that's all we have here for you folks today. Make sure you subscribe and leave us a review. Thanks for tuning in. Have a good day.
Yeah, great.